Okay, so to continue with the topic of Teshbisu and the Menchas Chinuch and some of his observations and some of the disputed points, of which there are many, and Menchas Chinuch did a tremendous service to the world of Lumdus by putting questions about this mitzvah so front and center. And as we'll see, he's also really served as a home base for a lot of argumentation. And we'll see, maybe a little more, but tomorrow, some disagreement with how he has taken on the issue. But just to consider a few points at a time. So one point that the Menchas Chinuch considers that also allows us to synergize with the topic that we spoke about at length before Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, the question of Akiras Davrim and HaTorah. If you recall that we spoke then about the reality that this year we didn't blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah or take a lulav on the first day of Sukkot, despite the fact that by Torah law we're required to do so. But the rabbis were given the authority to override that for a protective measure. And that's indeed what they did. And that's why we don't blow shofar, take lulav on Shabbos. So the Menchas Chinuch observes that it seems unusual if one is going to say that the mitzvah of Teshbisu is an active responsibility to do something affirmative and destroy chametz at a specific time. So then Chazal seem to have interfered very significantly, because since the Zman Isser Chametz Midrabanan is pushed up, it's earlier, so basically that means that Chazal stopped you from performing the mitzvah as it's supposed to be done. And if you were to say it's just a deadline, so they pushed the deadline up, they created a bigger buffer zone, so then we understand it very well. That makes a lot of sense. So in HaTorah, there's a certain deadline, and the rabbis didn't want us to tamper with, to risk crossing that deadline, so they pushed things up. But if it's really a specific mitzvah to do it then, and as Menchas Chinuch was considering that maybe one should specifically maintain or even acquire possession of chametz so that they can fulfill that mitzvah bezmano, and then the rabbis pushed it up from that time, so aren't they basically completely uprooting a mitzvah? And they're basically taking a mitzvah away in its totality. And, as he goes on to note, that if you're going to say, well, yeah, but they're allowed to do that, we saw that already, Yishkoach Lachar Davar Min HaTorah, they can tell us not to blow shofar or take lulav on Shabbos. But we also noted that, as many Achronim explain, and Menchas Chinuch among them, that they can't completely remove a mitzvah. So the question that was raised, for example, why don't we say that you shouldn't just refrain from blowing shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, but even when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Rosh Hashanah, right? Why don't we say that because there's in general a prohibition to play musical instruments on Shabbos and Yantif, because of the concern of fixing the instrument, so we should cancel shofar blowing every Rosh Hashanah? So the answer that many gave to that question is that no, it doesn't make sense that the power of the rabbis extends so far, not just to contradict a little bit some detail of a mitzvah, but even to completely remove a mitzvah, that they can't blow shofar. That they can't do totally and tell us not to blow shofar at all. So if that would remove a mitzvah in its totality, that's out of their power. So then ask the Menchas Chinuch, so how could it be that they could tell us not to fulfill Teshbisu at all? Isn't that problematic? Ari?
Because it doesn't seem like the rabbis are being ma'akir this notion of Tashbisu. They're just saying perform it at a separate time, and that seems to be like the Torah gave over to the rabbis the authority to mandate when and how and where this Torah obligation should take place. That doesn't seem to be a question of Akira.
Well, it seems like you might be combining that with another idea that we spoke about, which we don't know if that's relevant to this, although it's true that the Ketzav Mishnah invoked it here. But the idea of Masra Akasav Chachamim, that if we're applying, it is genuinely confusing because all these concepts are meeting at the traffic stop and they're all trying to get space at the same time. But the idea that Chazal gave the mitzvah over to the rabbis to define what it was, which the Ketzav Mishnah considered in terms of the relationship between bittel and beer. So that's where it comes into this conversation. So then, yes, you're right. So they could say, all right, that we decided it should be this time. And the rabbis picked the time. But that's not the claim here. The claim here is that the time was halfway through the day. And the rabbi said, no, that's too late. Because since that's the time, we need to create a distance from it. We need to, you can't wait till then. And we need to push up the time. So if the time is always just a deadline, so great, so fine. They added to the time. Just like every Friday night. So Shabbat starts at a certain time, whatever it is that week. And if you assume that the Tosefa Shabbos is Drabanan, or at least expresses a voluntary act from people every Shabbos, so we create a buffer zone. We push it up, and there's no problem. There's clearly no issue with just starting Shabbos earlier than it would start, to just avoid doing Malacha earlier. But here, to say just stay away from Chametz earlier, if the mitzvah is to destroy it at that time, then we have now taken away that mitzvah completely, it would seem. Any other suggestions, Danielle?
Wouldn't this be more of an issue of baltosis?
Okay, so why would you call it baltosis?
Because you're keeping away from chametz for more than 7 days.
So it's interesting on a couple levels. You know, to call that baltosis when it is passive is probably not the usual application that we have. And you know, to say that baltosis means to do more than the Torah says. So then, that's one thing. But to say that the Torah says don't do this, and you're also not going to do that, so it's hard to call that baltosif, especially because it doesn't display any kind of additional kind of behavior. Now, it does have, like in the sense of kolamosif gareya, a siag component to it that you have to figure out whether it's too much or not. And the idea of creating rules overall has been a question why dinim d'rabbanan are not, in totality, an issue of bal tosif.
Right.
So that, you know, is a question we ask about all dinim d'rabbanan, but not necessarily this more than anything else. But maybe there is another approach with Yitzchak Zilberstein, so well known for so many other svarim. He also has many svarim. The Sefer called Avnei Chen, where he has comments on the Menachos Chinuch, and Menachos Chinuch overall is the very popular Sefer for people to publish their Ha'aros on. There's actually a Sefer, big volume, which is called the Shita Mekubetzes on the Menachos Chinuch, where he Xeroxed, it's basically there, and they say Xeroxed because it's there, like literally in Xerox form, the original typesetting of each sefer that is quoted, many comments from later Achronim on the Menachos Chinuch. But there's so many more, because there's so many who wrote on the Menachos Chinuch. So among them, Zilberstein has a sefer, Avnei Chen, where he says that it's true and it's not true. That yes, this does somewhat subvert a mitzvah in the Torah, but not in as dramatic a way as a mitzvah like shofar or lulav. And his point basically is that it's essentially a different kind of mitzvah than shofar. And that's why it's not as blatant an issue. Because the mitzvah of shofar is a positive mitzvah to do no matter what. So when the rabbi said, don't blow shofar at all on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which Minat Torah is the only day of Rosh Hashanah. So If they were to say that on Yontif also, right, don't blow shofar on any Yontif, meaning any Rosh Hashanah, don't blow shofar ever, so then there would be a affirmative value of shofar blowing, which would disappear. But if Teshbisu is different, but only subtly different, really, this is why it's important to appreciate this, that the mitzvah only applies, like the Avnei Nezer put it, the Avnei Mitzvah only applies to someone who has chametz. So if you don't have chametz, you just don't have the mitzvah at all. So then his assumption is that's different. Now whether that's satisfying or not is itself taking a stand on how the mitzvah is. That's what I want to appreciate here, that the nature of this question and this answer is further sharpening how one relates to the mitzvah of Teshbisu to begin with. Right, because he's basically saying that if this was a mitzvah like shofar, the Torah wants you to blow shofar somehow, so then to say we're never going to do it again because you can't do it on Yontif, that would be a big deal. But apparently Teshbisu, yes, it's a positive mitzvah, and it's not just about not having chametz, but still, it's only relevant when you have chametz. And somebody who never has chametz at all is not as eliminated as somebody who doesn't blow shofar. But that's itself a statement. That itself requires a certain premise about how to relate to this mitzvah. And therefore, it's not as dramatic and akira as saying don't blow shofar at all. So what I'm saying is that distinction is a little questionable because it maintains a certain premise about how to relate to this mitzvah. But that's how he wanted to suggest. He also comments there another point that Mishnah Tzinuch discusses, which also kind of gets into the mix here, that we know that based on this week's parsha, so we'll get a little synergy, right, that it's Rishon in this week's parsha. But in this week's parsha, so there is a din of, what's it, you have to really find it in this week's parsha, the end of first Aliyah of this week's parsha, so Yaakov makes the promise that Kol Asher Atitein Li Aser Asran Ulach, that everything you give me, I will give you a tenth. And the Gemara Masech Ksubis understands that the language of Aser Asran is a double tenth, that while we advocate giving tzedakah as a minimum of a tenth, but it's also got a maximum of a fifth, two tenths. And that it's not required or even maybe appropriate to give more than a fifth of your money to tzedakah because you may become impoverished. So the Ramah assumes that this is the same rule when it comes to mitzvos. You shouldn't spend more than a fifth of your money on positive mitzvos. Losa says a different story, but positive mitzvos, you're not supposed to spend more than a fifth. So Menachos Chinuch says that if you assume that Teshbisu actually requires some kind of doing something, that it's really a positive mitzvah, it's not just a passive state, so then maybe it should be subject to this rule that you should have to spend up to a fifth of your money, but also maybe not more than that, because it's not like a losa, say. Now, in order to say that, you're going to have to draw a distinction between Bayira, Bayimotze, and Teshbisu, because that has a losa, say. But that may also be defined differently. That we have to see when we talk about Bayira, Bayimotze. But this idea that maybe there's a factor of up to a fifth, not more than a fifth, by Teshbisu, that's one of the points that Chassidus discusses. But then he also raises another issue, that is that the only way we should look at it? That if it's a lo saseh or an aseh, if this is a mitzvah saseh, then we generally have a more lenient standard. A lo saseh requires us to give up all of our money, and a mitzvah saseh is limited. should we say this is more chamer than a regular positive mitzvah? Why should it be more chamer? Because the assumption is it's constantly regenerating. That every minute I haven't gotten rid of my chametz, so then there's a new obligation of tashbisa. And maybe that gives it more intensity. And this is based on a comment of the Ran, which Yosef Engel once again made prominent through a discussion he has. The Ran, in the Sefer Yuma, poses a question that let's say you have somebody who is sick and needs to be treated, and the situation is that it's Shabbos and he needs to eat something in order to be recovered, in order to recover from his sickness. But he has two choices. He needs to eat meat. And you have two options. You have either non-kosher meat, you have a nevela that's ready and available for him to eat, or you have a kosher animal that would need to be shechted on Shabbos. So how should you take care of this person? Being that we generally try to minimize the violations that we do for Pikuach Nefesh, we can suspend Averos, but we still try to do the least Averos that we can, the fewest Machil and Oso Akal Akal, try to do the fewest Averos or the least Chomer Averos that we can. So what should you do here? Should you shech the animal on Shabbos, or should you feed him nevela? So what would you advocate? Some of you might recall last when we learned Kulin, we talked about this Ran there a little bit, major discussion. So Zach, what would you recommend?
I would think that it's better to shech the kosher animal, because we have an idea that non-kosher animals are like
okay, that's an interesting factor to bring in, the idea of the impact of non-kosher food on the neshama. And there are others who bring that into the discussion, actually. And that we actually spoke about last year for those who were with us for Chulin. But the Ran comes from somewhere else. The point is well taken, but he factors in a different point. But initially, you may have said that you should feed the non-kosher food. But there's a svara for that, right? What's the svara for that? That we often use the metric of what is the more chomer avera from an onesh perspective. Right? So chil Shabbos is chiv skila karis, while eating nevela is just a lav. So it would seem from an Avera perspective that there is a greater Avera to be Machal Shabbos than to eat treif. So why shouldn't you just give him the treif? That would seem to be the initial perspective. So the question is there any reason to go a different direction? So Zach's point is well taken, that maybe treifus has a unique aspect to it, which some do break up. But the Ran here mentions something else, and the Ran says that the issue, the reason to actually prefer shechting the animal than feeding the nevela, is that every kezayis of the nevela is going to be an additional iser, and that eventually quantity comes to make an impact. So if you're going to shech this animal, that's just one action. But every kezayis in the veil is going to be its own aver. And that's an interesting, complex discussion. Rav Yosef Engel discusses this in an essay that he has, which is under the title, it's in the same Sefer Lekach Tov, where his piece about Siag Ben HaTorah that we referred to is there. But this essay has the title, Im Ribui HaKamus Machria Es HaEichus. Like kamos meaning quantity, and echos meaning quality. So does it ever happen that an increase in quantity ultimately determines the quality of something? So can you say, or should you say, that doing a lesser Aveira many times ultimately is worse than doing a more severe Aveira once? So Mechassinach raises this issue. Okay, so maybe we'll say that Tashbisu is a mitzvah saseh. But you're going to be confronted with it many, many times until you destroy the chametz. Every moment that you still have your chametz, it's like that mitzvah is yelling at you again. So does that ultimately turn it into a lo saseh? So that, as Zilberstein discusses also, and he raises the issue of why do we have this distinction against the synergy topic of this week's parsha. So why do we have this distinction between positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs? That positive mitzvahs only up to a fifth and negative mitzvahs all your money. Why do you have that distinction? So perhaps you're assuming that it's about severity, that negative mitzvahs are more chomer, so you really got to go all out to prevent them. While positive mitzvos are a little bit less, so you don't have to go as far, just a fifth. Since if that was your premise, okay, so then I hear it, and the fact that it's coming up again and again maybe kind of starts to accumulate. But he doesn't think that that's the distinction. He thinks the distinction is, it's all about, this again harkens back to our discussion about Akiras Dabrim and HaTorah, because we have that distinction also between Sheva Al-Tasa and Kum Va'aseh. So what is the issue? Is the issue severity accumulating? Or maybe it's a fundamental difference between passive and active. That when it comes to passive behavior, so if you're asked to do something and you just don't do it, so it could be that the reason there's a limit to how much you have to spend is because if you're going to bankrupt yourself, you're going to have to give so much of a percentage of your money, you're going to become poor. So that's going to impact you very negatively. So that's considered to be an onus. That's considered to be a situation where you just are not able to do it. Okay, so you can't fulfill that positive mitzvah. But when it comes to negative mitzvahs, so we're talking about committing a transgression. So then the point could be that you have no license to commit a transgression unless it's mamish pikuach nefesh. So if it's life or death, that's a different story. But if it's about anything less than that, so then you don't have a license to commit a transgression. So his point basically being that it's a absolute distinction between positive things and negative things. It doesn't matter how many times it accumulates. It's still going to be essentially just an omission. And therefore, it should be subject to the one-fifth rule. Okay? So far, so good? Everybody following? That's a little complicated. Okay. So there are a number of other issues which some of the svarim that came afterwards add to the Mechassinach list of nafkaminas. We spoke about some of the other nafkaminas last week. So some also pose a question. The sefer called Klei Gola, which is a recent sefer, past a few decades, where he talks about a lot of things, the Chol Torah Kul, and he also has a section on the Mechassinach. So he adds a few nafkaminas. One of the points he makes, which is actually a very significant point to consider, is in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Tashbisu, do we require that you have to get rid of every last drop of chametz that you have? Or, and you, until then you are not in fulfillment of Tashbisu? Or should we say that any of the chametz that you have that you destroy is a fulfillment of Tashbisu? And even if you still have additional chametz, so that can pose you other problems, but you are still fulfilling Tashbisu with whatever chametz you destroy. Or should you say that Tashbisu is an absolute? And until you've gotten rid of all of your chametz, it's not Tashbisu. It's a pretty significant question. And Rav Moshe Sternbuch has a tshuva about this. He has much to say about Tashbisu in general, because he has the Sefer on Zmanim, Moed issues, called Moedim Uzmanim, where he talks extensively about the concept of, Tashbisu there, but in his tshuvas later on, Chelek Hey is his tshuvas on Helgos, so he talks about this question. And one suggestion that he has is that maybe it should be defined by houses. So let's say if a person has many residences or he has many houses, so each one is its own mitzvah of Tashbisu. Because the language of the pasuk of Tashbisu Sa'orami Batechem, so that maybe the house has to be cleaned out of chametz. But if I have another house, still my problem, but still maybe it allows me to say I fulfilled Tashbisu completely regarding that house, which would add another layer to the definition of what this mitzvah means. He points out that there's a rivash that maybe sounds like this, because the rivash says that somebody has twin boys, and he has a bris milah to perform on the twin boys, so he can make one bracha for both. And the rivash says, how do you know? Because look at bedikas chametz. Somebody has a number of houses, so when he starts with bedikas chametz, makes one bracha, and then goes to do a bedikah and all of that. So you could ask, well, that's not really comparable, because bedikas chametz, it's all one personal obligation. So you should make one mitzvah, one bracha on all your houses. But the twin boys, each one has a separate mitzvah of milah. So what it seems like the Rivash is saying is that, no, it's not one personal obligation. All of your houses, each one is its own mitzvah. So the fact that you can make a bracha and then go from house A to house B to house C, so that shows you that you can make one bracha to cover multiple mitzvahs, because they're indeed separate. But as he notes, other Rishonim don't necessarily read it that way. Another issue that is proposed in this farm is the question of shlichus. Now, should we say that this is just about not having chametz? In which case, you could have non-Jews get rid of your chametz. They don't have to necessarily be a part of the notion of halachic shlichus. Or should we say that, no, this is your personal affirmative mitzvah? And so, first of all, mitzvah bo, yosim shlucha, better you should do it rather than involving anyone else. But even if you are going to have a shliach, then maybe it has to be a halachic shliach. Maybe it has to be a Jewish person who is obligated in Tashbisa. So that's itself a discussion. But Rav Sternbuch also suggests that maybe even if you want to say that it is an affirmative mitzvah, but it still doesn't require shlichus in the normal sense. Because maybe the idea is that Tashbisu, if you say like Chachamim, you say against Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda said it has to be specifically Sreifa. But if we paskin like Chachamim that any kind of destruction counts, so then maybe the message is that as long as I am personally involved in worrying that this chametz disappear, it doesn't really matter what kind of intermediaries I'm using, Jewish or non-Jewish, or human or not human, or alive or mechanical. Maybe it wouldn't matter in order to bring about this result of not having chametz. He notes in that context that there is a machlokas, the Shulchan Aruch, and the later Achronim. But the Shulchan Aruch says that, let's say, before the Zman of the Yisr, you toss your chametz outside so that the crows will eat it. But then, after the time of the Yisr, you come and you see the crows have not eaten it, and it's still there. So Shulchan Aruch actually says, so then you're going to have to destroy it then. And later Achronim disagree with that, and that's a whole discussion I'd like to fill in a little bit, because that's a very practical question of whether you can fulfill Tashbisu by just removing something from your house or not, putting it, let's say, in an outside garbage can. It's somewhat of a complex question. But aside from that question, which we can talk about separately, it says what you see from the Shulchan Aruch is that apparently putting it in front of the crows to eat it could potentially have been enough. The problem was they didn't actually eat it. But if they did, apparently that could have been enough. So what does that show you? Why don't we say that a crow is not a bar shlichus? You have a real mitzvah there. You can't make a crow your shliach. A raven, with all due respect to Noah, had different rules. So, how does that work? So, he suggests that the point is, it works because the nature of the mitzvah is that you should worry about it being destroyed. But not necessarily that the physical destruction itself has to be done by you directly. Another question that is raised is that if you say this is a personal mitzvah, so then the question is there room for kfiya? Is there room for coercion? This is not something that we see so much nowadays for a number of reasons, but the Gemara says in Tzuvos that theoretically at least the kofin on mitzvah saseh, that there is such a concept as does been coming in and compelling compliance with a positive mitzvah. So is there a role for kfiya here in such a case, in a society where that was practiced? Is there a role for compelling this mitzvah? Now, alternatively, the other side, actually, isn't necessarily that the Beis Din would have been completely passive and stayed out of it. But the Beis Din maybe theoretically could just confiscate the chametz and destroy it because they're of their interest in enforcing mitzvah observance. But if it's a positive mitzvah, so then that mitzvah wouldn't be accomplished through Beis Din just confiscating. So that question theoretically could also connect to this larger issue. Okay, so just to also call your attention to a few broader points about this whole consideration. Rabbi Chalap Zilvein Gesund has a sefer, it came out a few years ago. You know, Rabbi Chalap, it was before your time. You didn't have the schuss of being in yeshiva together with Rabbi Chalap. You should do well. Rabbi Chalap for many years was the menahel of the yeshiva. And he somehow managed to do a lot of learning at the same time and wrote many Cheshiva articles. And a few years ago, they were all collected together and published in a volume called Shefa Yomim. So one of the pieces there is about Bitul Chametz and about Tashbisu and how they relate to each other. And also this question that we discussed of where does the question of chametz yadua or she'ena yadua fit in? So the idea that some of the Rishonim have, maybe one Girsa and the Rambam, and a few others, that chametz yadua bristle doesn't work, so he thought that maybe that relates also, just like Reb Chaim said about Tashbisu, that is a machlokes about whether Tashbisu has to be, or Bir Chametz, is ain't Bir Chametz Ela B'Sreifa, according to Rabbi Yehuda, or Hashbasoso B'Chol Davar. So he thought that that was also related, because if you say ein bir chametz ela b'treifa, which the Gemara derives from nosar, from that which is left over from the mizbeach and has to be destroyed, that then the point is that the mitzvah that relates to the chametz that you find is that you have to and take it and destroy it. So that would also tell you that bittul is not going to work for chametz yaduah. But if you say that hashbasaso b'chol davar, it could be anyway, and that bittul also qualifies as hashbasa, like the view of Rashi, so then that theoretically could work. That might be relevant to that. I think also a point to consider is that the Gemara, you saw on the bottom of Heyim and Aleph, Gemara has a machlokas, what exactly is the mucker for the din that Chatzos min HaTorah on Erev Pesach is the time for Tashbisu. And the Gemara has two possible sources. So one source is the pasuk Ach b'yom harishon Tashbisu sorim batechem. And the Gemara says, Ach cuts a line between the two halves of the day and makes it chatzos. But what's the other possibility? What's the other source in the Gemara? Yeah, Ari?
Not slaughter the
carbon pesach when your chametz are still in existence. Right. That you shouldn't shech the carbon pesach when you still own chametz. And therefore, you're going to have to get rid of it before you do that. And it's actually a good question, who we paskin like. Because between those two sources, the Rush brings one and the Riff brings another. And the Rambam seems to bring both. So if you say that it's from the pasuk of Lo Sishchutu Al Chametz Dam Zichi, then you're not allowed to shech the carbon pesach when you're in the possession of chametz. So first of all, it brings up all kinds of questions. Where is that nowadays? And nowadays we don't have carbon pesach at all. Should that affect our whole obligation of bir chametz and tashbisu? Should we say that it doesn't apply? Or what happens if somebody shechs the carbon pesach and then acquires chametz afterwards? In between then and later. So should we say that they're not going to be in violation of the Sitzer because when they shechted the carbon pesach, they were indeed divested of all chametz? So that's something we have to figure out. But perhaps it's also relevant just to the question we started off with, that essentially what the Gemara is asking here is there is some broad obligation of destroying chametz, which kicks in anticipation of Pesach. If I want to be really more accurate here, Father Zirik used to point this out all the time also, that what we colloquially call Pesach is really called Chag HaMatzos. Right, that from the night of the 15th, and on is Chag HaMatzos, and Erev Chag HaMatzos is really its own day. That's called Chag HaPesach. And so Pesach is actually the 14th of Nisan, which is when Tashbisu seems to kick in. But the idea that you should either do Tashbisu as a part of anticipation for Chag HaMatzos, or Lo Sishchutu Chametz Dam Tzivchi is focusing on the Karban Pesach specifically. And that's relationship to Chametz. So that may tie in to the question that we started off with. We began this, the question of how to relate to the whole package of matzah. Are we going in a positive direction? Eat matzah. Don't eat chametz because it's the opposite of matzah. Don't even own chametz and in fact destroy chametz. Is that the continuum? Or is it chametz bad, should never have chametz, especially not on Pesach, and it's so bad, don't own any, don't come near it, don't, et cetera, et cetera. So, if you want to take a more positive approach, like the first way, to say that there is a message here of endorsing the Nisan, like the Sefer Achinuch seems to say, that all of these mitzvahs, not just matzah, but the Isra of eating chametz, the Isra of owning chametz, and Tashbisu, it's all part of the reinforcement of the miracle experience. So then perhaps it's more easily understandable how it is associated specifically with the carbon. That the carbon, which is clearly a affirmative expression of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, so if we want to say that part of that message is the eating of matzah and the avoiding of chametz, and that that extends to the shechita also, it all becomes a part of the endorsement of that message of remembering the Nisan of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But then that's distinct probably from saying chametz is bad, and this is all about emphasizing the badness of chametz. So it could be, maybe to some extent, I don't know how it's going to line up, but maybe to some extent, these two different makaros also play a role in terms of determining what exactly is the message regarding chametz. So a lot of this is bouncing off the Minchas Chinuch, and some of it filtering through the Minchas Chinuch, some of it expanding on the Minchas Chinuch, but some of it also arguing on the Minchas Chinuch. And that is a point that we will see expressed a little bit more tomorrow. Rabbi Weiss and a few others take issues, so that's a point that we still want to add a little bit more to clarify. And I'll give you some more makaros tomorrow to look at, but one of the things to note as the Ramban that you already saw regarding Bittul Chametz, the Ramban in the beginning of the Masechta. So a part of that question is, does the Ramban maybe anticipate, as some Achronim understood, the view of the Minchas Chinuch, or is he saying something different? So that, God willing, we will start with tomorrow. So just to quickly recap what we spoke about, so we spoke about a number of questions about the issue of if chametz, if tashbisu is an affirmative mitzvah that's supposed to be at a specific time and Chazal pushed it up, so then is that not only an akiras davar min haTorah, but it's more than saying don't blow shofar on Shabbos, it's closer to saying don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It's a complete uprooting of a mitzvah in its totality. So Zilberstein said no, because here the mitzvah only is going to apply if you have chametz, so it's basically taking you out of having the obligation rather than telling you to skip the obligation. But that itself is a big question whether that should help or not, because that itself makes a certain assumption about what Tashbisu is and how it may differ from other mitzvahs, and that's interesting. And then we talked about whether it should be treated like an assay regarding spending money that derives from this parsha, or should we say it's more like a los assay because of the accumulation of opportunities, and discussed that Rav Zilberstein drew a distinction related to that issue as well. And then we talked about a few extra chakiras, the question of, is this mitzvah fulfilled with any chametz to destroy, or does it davka require getting rid of all of it, and there's no tashbisu until it's all gone? We talked about Shnerbach's tshuva about that, and possible distinctions between different houses. If you own many houses, maybe that makes a difference to the tashbisu for each one, etc. And then we talked about shlichus, how shlichus plays a role here. Is there no need for shlichus, or is there a need for halachic shlichus, or is it kind of somewhere in between? That maybe it's not about shlichus if you're going to involve, let's say, even an animal in destroying the chametz. Maybe that's still considered to be your fulfillment of your responsibility to worry about it. We talked a little bit about kfiya. Is there a role for Beis Din to compel this mitzvah? And then we got into Rav Chalaf's point about how the machlokes between chachamim about whether Bir Hamit requires Sreifa specifically or not, how that reflects on this whole issue. And then we talked about the idea that there are two Makoros in the Gemara, one of them being about Shechitas Korban Pesach, and not being 100% clear what Makor we follow. And if you say it's about the Korban Pesach, would that perhaps fit more into a theme of this all being a positive enhancement of remembering the Yetzias Mitzrayim? And maybe that would take on a different implication as far as some of his other questions. And then we left off with a question of, to go back to the Ramban, to the Mishnah Tzinuch's premise, to what extent is it debatable or not? And I mentioned that the role of the Ramban in perhaps foreshadowing or taking a different stance than the Mishnah Tzinuch is a point that we will pick up with tomorrow. Okay, I wish you all a wonderful day. Should be only good things. And I will see you, God willing, at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Yes, Yeshua.
Can I tell them?
Yes, Shaykh.